My name is Mike Starr of Blazing Star Barbecue, and you are listening to the Leonard and Jeff on the Baseball Barbecue Podcast. Please tune in for all their great topics. Promise you, you won't regret it. Oh, yeah.
The studios of Baseball and BBQ on Long Island, New York. This is episode number 208 of Baseball and BBQ. I'm Jeff the Oku Cohen. That guy over there is Leonard Hollywood Aberman. We welcome you back to our podcast, Leonard.
Hello, Jeff. Hello, audience. Episode 208. Can't say that it isn't an exciting one, because it certainly is. Two great guests, one baseball, Greg Olson, former Major League Baseball player, Aaron Epstein from Coney Island Sorcery. We're so glad you joined us. And let me just tell everyone, before we get started, Jeff, let's do this right away, because it's got to do with baseball. It's a Texas showdown in the postseason, and Bet Online is your number one source for all your baseball wagering information. With up-to-the-minute stats, news, scores, and matchup breakdowns, get the latest game odds, spreads, and totals for the NFL and college football at your fingertips with BetOnline's real-time updates on statistics, news, and odds. We have everything you need to stay up to speed on each league championship series all the way through to the World Series. Head to the website today or use your mobile device to get in on the action. Don't forget to use promo code BLEAV. That's B-L-E-A-V to receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. Bet online. It is where the game starts. Jeff, briefly, talk about, we're recording this on a Tuesday night. Very well could be, I guess it will be, that come when we release this on Saturday, the Texas series will be over.
Could be. Could be.
Texas right now is up 2-0. And of course, anyone listening on Saturday will say, well, of course, and this is how it went. Although,
yeah, exactly.
If Houston does come back, they'll still be playing the series, actually.
Right. But you know what? People who are listening to this now know that. We don't know that as we're recording, but they
no
know
idea.
That.
That's, you know, they're not listening to, this is not the show to listen to for current events. That is definitely not.
Who do you want to see in the World Series? Now we're down to four teams. Who do you want to see?
Okay. I want to see the Texas Rangers, because.
With former Mets Jacob deGrom and Max Scherzer.
Yes. Yeah. And I want to see the Philadelphia Phillies.
Well, see, that's where we differ. I want to see the Houston Astros, and I want to see the Arizona Diamondbacks, which I know probably not going to happen. But the Phillies, yeah, they're on a roll. They just get hot like they did last year. I can't stand Bryce Harper with that stupid throat-slashing gesture. What is wrong with him? I know he's a great player. He gets up to the big game. But really? The throat-slashing? Come on.
Yeah, it's not necessary, very inappropriate. But look, Jeff, I'm a very loyal person. Philadelphia, they showed us the great time years ago when we first started doing this show. And since then, I've pledged my support. If the Mets aren't in it, then I'll root for the Phillies. That's just because I'm a loyal guy, you know?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, all right.
And Bryce Harper, yes, don't like the slashing of the throat, all that stuff. But so far, that contract, it's paying off. 13-year contract, they're yep. getting their money's worth.
Yeah, well, he brings home a world championship, it'll be worth it. So,
So you want Houston and Arizona. Now, Houston's been there, though. You want to see someone else get there?
No. I want to see Houston and I want to see the Arizona Diamondbacks. I like to see that Cinderella story.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, the Phillies could be like the 2014/15 Royals. They get there one year. They don't win it. They get there the next year and they win it.
Could be. Could be.
Right.
Yep. And you know what? A lot of people have been complaining about the format of the playoffs. You know, the 100 win teams are out, and they don't like the format. Well, you know what? I say boo freaking who. You know why? Because the Major League Baseball and the Major League Players Association, they agreed to this format. They negotiated. They had this CBA. It's part of the negotiations. If they don't like it, they can change it with the next CBA. But you know what? They have no right to complain.
No, none. And I look, it's baseball. It's the hot. The team that's hot at that time is going to win.
And speaking of hot, we have Aaron Epstein of Coney Island Sorcery with his hot sauce business.
Nothing's hotter than his sauces. No team is hotter, Jeff. But we start with Greg Olson, former Major League Baseball player. Great interview.
14 years. Yes. Yeah. So listen and enjoy. We have with us on Baseball and BBQ a 14-year Major League pitcher, drafted number 4 in the first round by the Baltimore Orioles. He was the 1989 Rookie of the Year with a record of 5-2 and 27 saves with a fantastic 1.69 ERA. An All-Star in 1990 and in 1991 saved the combined no-hitter when Baltimore defeated the Oakland A's. It was called a relay no-hitter. Spent the majority of his career with Baltimore and as part of the Orioles Hall of Fame, as well as the National College Baseball Hall of Fame. He is a color analyst for ESPN and the author of We Got to Play Baseball, 60 Stories from Men Who Played the Game. We welcome Greg Olson to Baseball and BBQ. Welcome, Greg.
Welcome, Greg.
Hey, guys. Thank you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And I want to talk about, you know, your career, but I didn't realize that you were also an ESPN analyst. You just did the Yankee game the other day, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I did the Yankees Red Sox Saturday. I have Giants Braves Saturday and Sunday of this week. So doing a little bit of ESPN radio, and then I'll do some Orioles TV early next week.
Nice, nice.
Yeah.
Greg, doing the games, are you now, being a former player, do you have to watch what you say, or do you just say it like you see it?
I don't think we're in a world that I can say what I want to say. that if it's sailed, you know, I could get into something about the Orioles and their play-by-play guy and what he said. You know what? You really have to be careful what you're saying. And it was kind of fascinating for me. I've been doing college baseball for a couple of years now, and my partner Clay Matvick of the regionals and super regionals for the last 2 years, and I find a way. Somebody hates me, and it's fine. They don't, you know, whatever team I'm calling for thinks I'm biased for another team, and I have zero dogs in any fight. But you know, I got hammered by the Southern Miss fans, and it was kind of comical because I kind of looked at him. I was like, these guys have no idea who, you know, if I'm rooting for anybody. I'm actually just kind of rooting for a fast, well-played game. And he just looks at me, he goes, you know what? We do what we do, and we should get paid well for what we do, because there's not very many people that can go on the air for 3 hours and not say something that would get them fired.
Right.
And I was like, you know what? That's a pretty valid entry. I hadn't thought of that. I try not to think of it, but you have to find a way to run through your thoughts before you say them out loud, because smallest, slightest innuendo of anything turns into, I'm not working anymore.
Something tells me that you're not that happy the way the game has changed since the way you played.
No, I wouldn't say that. It's a different world.
Yeah.
It's different. I was watching the Yankees Red Sox, and yeah, there were guys like what Giancarlo Stanton's doing right now, where they hit 200 with 25 bombs. And if you threw a pitch in you know, their happy zone, which was smaller than everybody else's, it was going to be a home run. And if you made your pitches, you got them out. And there were those same guys all over the place. And I just think there are a lot more of those guys that have holes. You know, you would have guys, and I'll never forget Gary Gaetti, who was somewhat of a power guy in the 90s, you know, with an 0-2 count, and I try to get him on a fastball away, thinking he was looking for something else, and he just hits a little routine ground ball between first and second. He was all he was doing just shortened up his stroke and just put the ball in play. And that game is gone.
Yeah.
And so I feel like it's a lot easier to get these hitters out. I feel like the pitchers have better stuff, worse control. I just think the game is basically turned into Earl Weaver's version of the Baltimore Orioles, where I get two guys on and try to hit a 3-run home run.
Right. 3-run homer. Exactly. Exactly. Well, let's start at the very beginning or close to it. You knew you wanted to play in the major leagues. As far as I know, from back when you were in fifth grade, you thought you were going to be a major league ball player.
Nice call there. Yeah, nice pickup. Well done. Yeah.
I did my research.
What are you going to grow up to be? And fireman, police officer, teacher? I'm going to be a baseball player. And I, some reason, really had no doubt up until I struggled my freshman year at Auburn. I struggled when I got to Double A for a month. Other than that, really, there wasn't a whole lot of times where I just didn't sit there going, this is what I'm going to do. And I can't explain it. It was just one of those where this is what I want to do. This is what I'm going to do. This is what I'm going to work to do. I'm good at doing it. And it worked out.
You had a coach in high school that was very close to you, didn't you?
Yeah, my father coached me. Didn't ever coach any of my little league stuff. And then when I got to high school, I made the junior varsity team from eighth grade. And then I was one of only two freshmen on the varsity team. We won the state championship that year. Had some really good players. You know, one went to Texas Tech, one went to South Carolina, a couple to Creighton. And I was one of the only two freshmen on that. And then my sophomore year, I got the ball and blossomed. But yeah, my dad was my coach. It was rocky for the first couple of years. In my senior year, I kind of became, I guess, the leader that he wanted me to be, but he was pushing me for that in my junior year, and that was a bit of a struggle for me. And so that was probably most of our struggles. We didn't talk about the game when we got home, and we might talk about it in the 20-minute car ride home, but once we got home and ate dinner, we didn't talk about it, which was good. And I mean, we still have a great relationship. It was just, you know, for a little while he wanted me to be the leader of the team, and I wasn't in that spot. And so I didn't take to it. I let the seniors that year, we had some good seniors, went on to play at Auburn, one went on to play at Creighton. Like I said, had some really good players. Just it wasn't my spot to be the dude, even though I was the dude on the mound.
Greg, you had a 53-game winning streak in high school. 53 straight wins.
That was the high school team, yes.
Yeah. I can't even imagine what that's like to win 53 straight. But what I really want to know is not what it feels like to be in a winning streak like that, but what does it feel like when you finally lose a game?
You know what? My dad was a really good coach. He is a really good coach. And we were better prepared. We probably had some of the best talent, but we never beat ourselves, ever. They laid down a bunt. We knew exactly what was going to, you know, what was going to go on at first and third play. There was not a sequence of plays or anything that ever got us, rattled us, beat us. And so if you were going to go about and beat a team that was either equally talented or more talented, they had to give you something. And we didn't give anybody anything. And the one game that we lost was my was my senior year, and we had our number three pitching against a really good team's number one. And then two of the guys ended up playing in AAA, and there one of their guys was a pitcher. And, I mean, dude was good. Dale Kasaitis. I haven't forgotten the game. They walked me four times, so I was completely out of play. And we lost 5-2, and our number three gave up some runs, and it was just one of those days. And we ended up getting them the next time, and I think I pitched, and we beat them 9-1. And they pitched to me, and I had six RBIs. So got him back, and then we didn't even see him in the state championship. So it was just, it was one of those days. It was a great run. It was way longer than it should have been. You know, I mean, I can't think of all the 1-0 games that I had on the mound of where you're scrapping for one run and I gotta keep a team down to nothing. And so it was just one of those streaks. It was unbelievable, bizarre, and we just found ways to win games.
Did you ever want to play another sport? Because you passed up a football scholarship from the University of Nebraska to play baseball. Did you ever have any regrets about that, or baseball was your number one?
No, that was an easy decision. It was a fun decision because it came. I had the baseball coach of Nebraska sitting in my living room talking to me and my dad, my mom, and Tom Osborne called to offer me a full ride to play football at Nebraska as either an offensive or defensive tackle. And I was like, Coach, it is probably the greatest honor to talk to you, but it would be a really stupid decision for me to put on another, give or take 90 pounds to be your left tackle, or keep my weight where it is and keep doing what I'm doing in baseball. So was a real hard decision. I mean, if I could have played quarterback and pitched, it would have been a different conversation, or center field and safety might have been a different conversation, but pitcher and, you know, tackle. I had to make a choice right there.
What made you choose to go to Auburn University?
I got lucky enough to play on a junior Olympic team in 84. And we got the silver medal, lost to Cuba in the gold medal game. And we had Jack McDowell, Albert Bell, and a guy named Mike Ignatiuk, and myself all made it to the big leagues from that team. So we had a really good team. And so I was being recruited by pretty much everybody but the West Coast. And I headed down to Arizona, Mississippi State, Arkansas, Tennessee, Auburn. I'm missing one. Arizona, Arkansas, Mississippi State, Tennessee. Yeah. And I kind of looked around the room, and Tennessee wasn't a good spot. Arkansas wasn't in a good spot. They obviously are now, and so is Tennessee. And Mississippi State was losing Will Clark, Palmeiro, Thigpen, Brantley, and they were all getting drafted. So I was kind of looking across the field when I took my recruiting trip to Auburn, and Auburn was playing Mississippi State when they had all those guys. And Auburn swept Mississippi State here in Auburn. And I was looking across the field going, all those guys are gone. All these guys in the Auburn dugout are back. It's a really strong offensive team. I could probably be their number two starter Saturday morning if I really wanted to. And that was my decision. Mm-hmm. And it ended up being a good one. We made the regionals my sophomore year. Junior year was one of those that would have been an epic ESPN story if it would have happened now, where they actually had some concept of what they were doing, picking teams.
Right. At Auburn, your coach was Coach Baird.
Yes.
You want to always be a starter, but he gave you a role that you thrived in as a closer, and you led the NCAA with a 1.26 ERA in 1987. Not too shabby.
No, he and I actually talked after my freshman year, and I struggled as a starter. I couldn't handle pitching every Saturday, couldn't handle pitching, once a week, and was tired of watching, me being helpless on Tuesday, Friday, Sunday. And my arm was resilient. We went into the fall and we both had talked about doing something in relief. There was one or two teams that had guys that were kind of back end bullpen guys, and it was just starting, and kind of ran through in the fall, and I bounced back every day and did what I needed to do and really enjoyed the role. But it's funny because, okay, so my freshman year, I pitched 78 innings. my sophomore year as a closer, I pitched 78 innings. So it wasn't like I was out there for one inning. I was out there, my last college outing was 6 innings. Mm-hmm. So I was affecting, I had a hand in every game. And that was exactly what I wanted. Being a position player in high school, you want to play every day. And so absolutely loved it. We kind of, both of us kind of sat down and had the same concept, same idea. I started a couple games in 1997 with the Omaha Royals when I was down in AAA. Started a couple games for the USA team in 87. Other than that, strictly 600 some games in relief.
Greg, you're nicknamed the Otter. Otter. Why are you nicknamed Otter?
Some guy in AA, I can't think of his name, comedian in the clubhouse, said I looked like an otter. And sadly, my roommate in AA, my roommate on the road in the big leagues was Curt Schilling. And so we came up together September 1st of 1988, flew from Charlotte to Seattle and got into the clubhouse with everybody else, you know, taking care of whatever. And at some point, Curt, you know, called me Otter, which was my nickname. And Billy Ripken picked it up. Everybody picked it up and it stuck. It has nothing else other than the fact that some comedian said I look like an otter.
Okay.
And I then, thought it might.
No, there's nothing else to it. Billy Ripken then took it a step further and, you know, it became the friendly sea mammal. Yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, there's not a good reason. I don't think I look like an otter, but it stuck.
I thought it was an Animal House reference somehow, but apparently not.
Nope. No, nothing really to it.
Now, Greg, you sign in 88 for a $200,000 signing bonus. That's good money then. Good money now, but good money then. How does that affect you? And what's the first thing you want to buy?
I bought a 300ZX Nissan.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, that was it. I bought me a sports car. gave some to my agent, some to Uncle Sam, and then put the rest in the bank. And yeah, it's funny because honestly, it was, and I don't know why it's not written this way, but my agent was good enough that he found out that the Orioles, if they had the first pick, they were taking me over Andy Benes. And so Andy Benes made 224. So in some side deal, I got another 24. So I made exactly what he made to, at that point, break the record. It's not written that way, but is what it is.
Now, you were the highest relief pitcher ever picked in Major League Draft. That must have been some honor.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the Orioles were looking at me as a pitcher. Because I was the number one starter on the 87 Olympic or the Pan American team. And we had some guys that went to the big leagues on that. And so I was the number one starter on that. So I could evolve into a starter. I could pull out a slider. I could pull out a changeup and have a nice four pitch mix. I just think they looked at me as the best pitcher on the market. That was what it was. It wasn't necessarily as a reliever. And like I said, you know, my last outing was 6 innings. It wasn't exactly like I was your normal, you know, go one inning and blow it out.
Right. So you get to the major leagues and your manager is Cal Ripken first, but then it's a Hall of Fame, Frank Robinson, you know, one of the greatest of all time. How was he as a manager and how did he handle you?
Well, Cal Ripken Sr. got fired after 21 games or 6 games. Might be 6 games.
Yeah, 6 games.
He got fired. Yes. Yeah. And then I got drafted in June, went A-ball, AA, got called up in September, and it was Frank at that time. Frank was surly. Frank had expectations of players that he didn't understand why people didn't hit. Some of the guys didn't like him. Some of the guys did like him. I loved him. Absolutely loved him. He had an open-door policy. I could walk in. We had a fog game my rookie year, sometime in June, I think. And I had been closing, and it was the 2-1. We're beating the Yankees, and it was as packed in a fog as you would get in Baltimore. and they left our eighth inning guy in. And he gives a fly ball to left field. Phil Bradley loses it in the fog. We lose 3-2. And I was stupid enough. I was thinking I was 22. Thinking Frank had an open door policy. So I went walking in. I was like, that's my game. I had been a closer in the big leagues for all of about an hour. And he actually shut the door and had a conversation with me. Now, my pitching coach yelled at me because I told me I wasn't supposed to do that. But Frank was great. He just sat there and he was like, this is what I was thinking. This is what was going on. This is why I didn't put you in. And I was like, okay, thanks. And I walked out, and then my pitching coach yelled at me for a little while. And I was going, yeah, you know, looking back, you know, when I end up getting to be 35 years old playing in the game, I was like, I can't believe I did that. But Frank was great. He completely ran through what he was thinking, the scenario. And I was like, okay, yeah, that works. Yeah. I loved him. I really did.
Yeah, he gave you his rationale. That was
perfect. Way more than I deserved. Well, let's put it that way.
Right.
I deserve to be lit up and sent out of the room quickly quietly.
You win the Rookie of the Year award. First relief pitcher to win the Rookie of the Year award. That what an honor. What an honor to win that.
It was. It was shocking. You don't expect it. Even though, you know, at the end of the year, your numbers are better than the other two guys, you still don't ever expect it. It helped that the Orioles were in the race till the end. I got to my best version the last 2 months of the season when everything was on the line. And so I think everybody saw that. And yeah, it was really nice. There's a couple things that you look back in life that you don't realize the value, the importance, the moniker, and that's one of them. I really, you know, I was like, yeah, this is cool. And then you get done playing and you're 55 and you're going, all right, yeah, that was really good.
Now, you played with some of the Hall of Famers on that Baltimore Orioles team. And I mean, Cal Ripken Jr. was on a team, and Eddie Murray. And also Fred Lynn, who maybe should be in the Hall of Fame. I mean, he was a very good player as well. Yeah, that was a nice team that you had back then.
In 88, yeah, but everybody else was a little bit overaged and not where we needed to be in 88. 89 was a whole bunch of young guys, but Fred Lynn was gone. Eddie Murray was gone in 89. Yeah, it was pretty cool being in the room with those guys.
I don't want to forget to talk about this. You and your dad went into the Nebraska High School Sports Hall of Fame in 1999. You went in together, right?
He was one of the best coaches of all time in that state or Midwest or wherever you want to go. And he put up some silly numbers, won a whole bunch of state championships, totally deserved it, totally worked his butt off and loved it. And he still talks baseball, absolutely loves the game. I think he's 83 and he's helping out with another high school in the area, you know, with their pitchers. But he is, I don't think I've ever met a man that wants to learn more. So every time I would bring him in the clubhouse when I got there at 2 o'clock and he would come with me. And, you know, Jim Palmer's one of the announcers, talked to him. Mike Flanagan, Cy Young winner, talked to him. Mike Mussina, Rick Sutcliffe, Cal Ripken. And he'd go around the room, and if I didn't pull him away, he would be wearing them out with questions. And he would take every one of them. And, one of my favorite stories, and it's absolutely one of his, we play in a, you know, professional baseball golf tournament at Pebble Beach. And we're playing with Trevor and Glenn Hoffman. And that's our foursome. And he catches Trevor at some point. Might have been the first hole. I think it was the first hole. And he goes, how are you throwing that changeup? And Trevor grabs a golf ball and shows him the grip. And it's like a couple holes later, he's like, what was that grip again? And I mean, Trevor's showing him that the Vulcan changeup that he was so famous for. And my dad taught that for the probably next 25 years. Yeah. And that was what he was. He'd get, you know, he'd get Mussina's knuckle curve and figure it out. And my dad was a catcher in the Yankees chain
back in the 50s, you know, played D-ball, and he was a catcher, but he's become a really, really good pitching coach.
Nice. Yeah. Well, so, some catchers make great pitching coaches, like Dave Duncan was a catcher.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. My dad's talked to the best on earth about, you know, their pitches and what they do, and he's good at it. He deserved it.
That's terrific. Now, I want to ask, you go through, you've played for some really good managers. I mean, besides Frank Robinson, you had Bobby Cox was in there, Tom Kelly, Davey Johnson, Buck Showalter. And the story with Buck Showalter, and we all heard this, that Barry Bonds was walked intentionally with the bases loaded. And it sounded like it was a regular occurrence, but it was not. It was only once. However, I did not know until I read this that you were the guy who walked him intentionally. And you earned the save. And you earned the save.
1947 and Jimmy Fox or somebody, Mel Ott, somebody like that was the other one in 1947. Yeah, Buck didn't blink. Bonds wasn't playing in the eighth. Bonds wasn't playing. He had the off day. He came in to pinch hit in the eighth against Amari Telemaco. I came in out of the bullpen just to face Bonds. You know, I go 3-1. I was like, I'm not giving in. So I throw him a 3-1 curveball, which I rarely did, landed for a strike, and then I knew he was looking for another curveball, thinking I was, you know, not going to give him a fastball. So I threw my best fastball, amplified velocity by a couple miles an hour, and just painted the corner. It was flawless. Ball four. Everybody else in the league is punched out in a heartbeat. It's ball four. Right. He stands there, peels off all his gear, walks down 90 feet. Now I'm livid that he's walking down 90 feet. I get the next guy out, go into the ninth inning, get the first guy out, and then it pours rain for a little while. And I'm sliding all over the clay mound in Candlestick. And just, I couldn't keep my back foot. I couldn't keep my back foot settled. And so I was sliding a little bit and everything was off. Walk four more, give up a double to Kent. Kind of, I think that was about it. So it ends up Bonds comes back up with the bases loaded, two outs. I'm at about 50 pitches. I'm flat done. And we got a guy warming up in the bullpen that would not ever walk into a major league game, but he was left-handed with the threat, like they're going to pinch it for Bonds. And Buck just put the four fingers up. And I was standing on the mound, and I was running through how I was going to start, what I was going to do, because I was physically done. Right. Wasn't mentally done. I was physically done. He just put four fingers up, and I was like, okay, whatever. And then the next guy comes up, Brent Maine, and I didn't get Brent Maine out that well. I think he was like 4-for-10, and so it wasn't like a great matchup. And I get ahead 1-2 real quick, and I'm trying to punch him out. I'm trying to end the game. End up getting to 3-2 when he fouls off like five pitches.
Oh, gosh.
And I am flat throwing two-seam fastballs at 92 miles an hour in the middle of the plate, going, just hit it. And finally, you know, hits a mediocre line drive to right field. My right fielder loses it in the lights, makes it more eventful. Man, you know what? That's one of the other stories where you kind of look at, like I talked about my rookie of the year. I don't think I realized the magnitude of the situation of knowing that every May 27th, May 28th, you know, everybody on social media is going to be blowing up my walking Barry Bonds with the bases loaded.
Right.
But knowing that, there would have been a little bit more stress on me in the ninth inning when I was standing out there going, just hit the ball, Brent Maine. I don't care anymore.
Yeah. Greg, you were doing great with the Orioles, and then you had a very bad injury to your elbow. The fact that you pitched again later on is amazing. Coming back from an injury like that, as bad as it was, what's it like to have to rehab like that and put yourself through that, not knowing whether you're coming back? What was it like?
Well, I thought, I you know, for those listening, the Tommy John surgery was 50-50 if I'd ever throw a baseball again. And so I tore the UCL, and it was a 90% tear. And so at some point I had verified the theory that if I completely tear the ligament, I'm gonna damage the back of my elbow, but it's not gonna hurt anymore because the ligament's gonna be completely shredded. So I went about the process of trying to completely blow out the ligament. And when I was throwing bullpens 2 or 3 times a week, as miserable as it could possibly be, I described the pain level of somebody took a chainsaw and cut my arm in half. And I just kept going, kept lifting. And I had talked to Nolan Ryan after I had blown out, and he had done the same thing in 87 and threw through it. And so I was either going to throw through it or completely blow it out where I could throw through it again. I took his rehab program. We talked on the phone a couple of times. I called him at home. And this is Nolan Ryan, which was kind of freaking me out. He was great. He was like, you know, this is what I did. This, you know, gave me all the programs he did. And so I lifted so much and got everything around the ligament so strong that I was able to come back. And then 2 months from a completely torn ligament, I had just screwed up my mechanics. And that was the issue for the next year, 94 with the Braves, was my mechanics were so far gone. It had hurt so bad that I had taken out the use of my back leg for the most part, my front glove, anything that helped propel, I had taken out. And so that was the issue. It wasn't that I couldn't throw. It was the fact that I had completely wiped out my mechanics. I can't say I regret it because I came back and pitched the next 8 years.
Yeah, you did.
Blew it out again. And that one, I was like, okay, I'm 35. I'm too tired for this. So I don't regret the decision. I really don't. I wish that, you know, Tommy John would have been what it is now and I could have taken a year off and come back, but I didn't have that option.
But you actually were able to come back from that, which is unbelievable. When you hear about all the, how bad that injury is, and you came back, you somehow rehabbed and it healed and or to some extent, and you came back, you had, what was it, 30 saves with the Diamondbacks?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. 98. I came back 2 months later and faced one hitter, Albert Bell, you know, in a meaningful major league game, which was kind of shocking, in September of 93. But other than that, it was a struggle to kind of find my mechanics again and figure out what I was. My curveball was a little bit less than what it used to be. My fastball was a little bit less than what it used to be. And so I had to kind of evolve to a different person, picked up a changeup, which really bought me another 6-7 years in my career. It became a really, really good pitch for me.
Now, you also had another health scare later on with prostate cancer. I'm sure you're familiar with Ed Randall's group, Fans for the Cure. We ran into Ed Randall last week, and he's, you know, given us out more material. How has he helped you with the diagnosis?
You know, it's just somebody to talk to, and it's been really amazing. It really has. The outreach, the outpouring has been great. I had the radical prostatectomy in 2021, I believe. A close friend of mine that played with the Orioles had the same thing in 2020. We talked a lot, ran through everything, talked to Ed, and I came out on Twitter with it. With, you know, I have strong faith in Jesus Christ. Came out with everything and didn't know why I was doing it for a real reason. And it ended up being a real platform for my faith. And this past year, you know, the numbers popped back up a little bit, which means that, yeah, they got my prostate, but the cancer cells had gotten out before that. So I had 39 radiation treatments. Mm. And I came out again on Twitter with what was going on. And then I decided to change it around and really go, you guys are all praying for me. How can I pray for you? And it became a real platform of prayers for people out there that are struggling. And it's been amazing.
No, we're glad you're doing better now. That's for sure. Yeah, absolutely. Before we let you go, I do have one last question about you being on the Wall of Fame at Plainsman Park, the Auburn baseball stadium, along with Frank Thomas, Bo Jackson, and Tim Hudson. That's some pretty cool company.
It's really cool. Yeah. No, it was really cool. I don't think another one of those. I didn't realize what was going on when it happened. Hudson, in my mind, I kind of look at the numbers going, he's got a real shot at the Hall of Fame. You know, the wins are low at 221, but got 133 losses, which is an absolutely stupid win percentage. And then Bo Jackson probably being the greatest athlete that our last couple generations have seen. I have a hard time going back to maybe Jim Thorpe. And then Frank Thomas is the only SEC player in the Hall of Fame. So to be on that list is very it's awesome. It really is.
Now, Greg, what people don't know about you is, and maybe based on this, they should have made you a hitter. Your only major league hit. And for people to say, wait, his only hit was a home run. You didn't bat a lot as a relief pitcher. And your only major league hit was a home run. Maybe you should have been. Maybe you could have been like the Shohei Ohtani of the time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was a really good hitter in high school, but a lot of guys were really good hitters in high school. Yeah, that one's kind of comical because I was 1-for-4. Struck out 3 times. So the only time I put the ball in play was a home run. And then the next year I come in and mop up a game to close it out for the Diamondbacks. And I don't know what I was doing. It's cruising through the 7th and then finished the 8th. So I got an at bat and I walked on 4 pitches. So on base plus slugging is 1400. It's entertaining.
Remember, and remember who you got that hit off of?
Oscar Henriquez. I don't know if he ever came back up. He got sent down about an hour later.
another accolade for you is that Sports Illustrated named you one of Nebraska's 50 greatest sports figures of the century. And Nebraska's had a lot of great athletes, so that's quite the honor as well.
Yeah, it was. It really was. Yeah, there was that was really cool. Yeah. They didn't throw any of my my football accolades on there. So I was going, you know, you probably could have moved me up a little bit.
And then one more for me is that you almost played in the Olympics, but you had mono.
Yeah, that was a rough break. I told you, 87, I was on the Pan American team, sophomore. And had been closing all year. We got Chris Carpenter from Georgia, who was holding out from his professional contract with Scott Boras. And he was more of a two-pitch guy. I picked up a slider and a changeup. So I ended up starting, I think, 4 games in the Pan American Games as a starter. And I hadn't started all year with Auburn. And then the next year was the number one starter or reliever or whatever. I think it was the only reliever on the staff. I had mono from probably March to the end of the season. And so I walked into camp and it was Mark Marcus, the great Stanford coach. Skip Burtman was the pitching coach from LSU, another Hall of Fame coach. And I walked into the room going, I can't run. I can throw a couple innings. I get really tired. I need naps. Leave me alone. I will be here in September. And then first day of the Olympic camp, they go, all right, here's a 5-mile run and only do what you can do. I was going, I'm walking 5 miles and you guys can come get me in a couple hours because I'm going to be somewhere down that way. And that was exactly what happened for the first week of camp, where it's just like they sent everybody off on a run. And some guys like Charlie Nagy and Ben McDonald could run for days. And I was like, if I go run a mile, I'm going to sleep right at the end of the mile. So I'm going to just walk. And then like 2 hours later, they come find me somewhere. And I'm going, I need a nap. And so at the end of like 3 weeks, I was exhausted and physically beat and I had to leave.
Well, Greg, we appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
One last question. Any other books in your future?
Thinking about it, I've been working with ESPN and getting some broadcasting. If I see more guys on the road, I might start picking up their stories. If I get more of their stories, then yeah, I love the book. It was so much fun hearing all these stories. And I still got about 120 of them on my computer I haven't used, but the 60 we used were really good.
Yeah. Well, we really appreciate your time. Thank you very much. Greg Olson, All-Star Rookie of the Year. Greg, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Nice talking to you guys.
Nice talking to you, too.
Hi, this is Gary Mack of the Mets Musings Podcast. And if you like barbecue and you like baseball, then you have to listen to Baseball and BBQ with Jeff and Lynn. They always have the best guests from the world of baseball and the world of barbecue, all in one little package. So check it out. Baseball and BBQ with Len and Jeff. Okay, guys, take it away.
And we want to thank Greg Olson for joining us on Baseball and BBQ, an interesting Major League Baseball player, right, Leonard?
Yes. A lot of fun. Great interview. He was a player for a while, and, you know.
Yeah. Now he's in the broadcast booth.
Yeah.
Does a great job.
Yeah. Appreciate him coming on. And Jeff, you know what else I appreciate? What's that? I know you do too. Grilling tools and accessories from baseballbbq.com. That's right. Baseballbbq.com. Baseball bat handle. I just used my tongs, my barbecue tongs just the other night. I made barbecue chicken and, you know, slather the sauce on and you got the chicken on. And sometimes it gets a little slippery, not with these tongs. They held it in place perfectly. So baseballbbq.com. And also, you know what? You need a cutting board shaped like home plate. You must have one. Am I wrong?
Absolutely.
All right.
Absolutely. And if you want to try to reach the show, give us a call at 516-855-8214. We have a Facebook page. Leave a comment there. Baseball and BBQ. Instagram, Baseball and Barbecue, with barbecue's all spelled out. We have an X or Twitter at Baseball and BBQ. Email us, baseballandbbq@gmail.com. And visit our website, www.baseballandbbq.weebly.com. Please rate, review, subscribe. Tell your friends, follow us, Leonard.
Subscribe. Come on, just give us the love, please. All right. Yes. Jeff, I got something else.
What's that?
Barbecue quote of the week.
Barbecue. It's not just a meal. It's a ritual. Ed Mitchell.
Very good. Very true.
And you know what is great on barbecue?
What's that?
Hot sauce. And you know what? We've got Aaron Epstein from Coney Island Sorcery. And these bottles are so cool because they've got the Trailer Park Boys on them. I know a lot of people are fans of that show, the Trailer Park Boys. So hopefully you'll be fans of our interview with Aaron Epstein. So please listen and enjoy. We met our guest on a hot day at Pig Island. And his sauces are even hotter and a lot tastier. Our guest is Aaron Epstein, founder. We're going to take over the company. Our guest is Aaron Epstein. He is the founder of Coney Island Sorcery. And before we welcome Aaron, I just wanted to read something from his website that says a lot about him. Company founder Aaron Max Epstein's fondest childhood memories of growing up in Brooklyn, New York, with trips down to Coney Island with his dad and brother, where they indulged in sketchy rides and ate raw clams and hot dogs at the original Nathan's famous hot dog stand. As a seasoned graphic designer and a hot sauce wizard, Aaron grew an appreciation for the iconic, gritty, vintage style and history of Coney Island. Aaron, we are so happy to welcome you to Baseball and Barbecue.
Hey, I'm super happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Started off, Jeff. I took so much with that intro.
It's pretty epic. I don't know how to come back from that.
Aaron, like Len said, we met you at Pig Island and Staten Island. Tell us about your origin story growing up in, I assume it was Brooklyn, and how you got started in the hot sauce business.
Well, I grew up in South Brooklyn. I grew up in Bensonhurst and Midwood. And when I was a kid, the back of my window, you could see the parachute jump from the distance. Because there was less, I guess, high rises. I'm sure the same window view is different now, right?
Right. Uh-huh.
I've been going to Coney Island, Brighton Beach. You know, that's where we went as a family, to the beach my whole life, just enjoying the rides and whatnot. My dad used to take us to Nathan's when I was a kid, and they had, like, you know, that's where I was introduced to, like, cherry stones, little necks, clams, frog legs, because that's the only Nathan's in the world that serves fried frog legs. The bathrooms were way different than they are now. They're made out of wood. You know, I guess it was the original wood. You know, it's like, it was just, Coney Island was completely different. It's like a different world than it is now. But I've been going there my whole life. You know, I got tight kind of with the burlesque sideshow scene a little bit. There's a little backstory. In 2008, me and my business partner from, you know, with this business, we came out with a DVD called Yule Go Go, which was a burlesque U-Log DVD. If you know any WPIX U-Log, sure. They play every Christmas.
But this is a burlesque one.
Yeah, so we re-recorded the music. It was all, like, public domain because, you know, it was over 100 plus years old. We had, like, for instance, we had this Little Brooklyn, was her name, is a burlesque dancer, and she dressed like Rudolph, and she stripped in front of the fireplace. So you could turn it on, make a TV into a burlesque fireplace, and her pasties and her nose glowed. Okay. So, you know, I've been around that scene for a little bit, you know, and how I got into hot sauce basically was my day job forever. And I still have a business doing that is graphic design, printing, animation, web development, web design, all that dev stuff and design stuff. And I was literally, no joke, it's kind of joke-ish, but I was in the bathroom reading, and my favorite part, time to read is in the bathroom, because you got a few minutes sometimes, you know, sometimes you got to make sure you did the job right. So I sat there, I had Entrepreneur magazine, and I was reading Entrepreneur magazine, and it said that, you know, the incline of hot sauce, and I've always eaten spicy. My dad always grew hot peppers in the backyard, and I decided, like, I was like, you know what, let me check this hot sauce thing out. And I checked it out. I was like, I didn't realize there was such a scene for it. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. So a year later, I ended up becoming a retailer online under hotsaucewillies.com. And we sold over 150 hot sauces, barbecue sauces, rubs, spicy chocolates and whatnot. And, you know, that lasted about 5 years. And the problem is like when you're doing retail online, you're competing against Amazon, you're competing against the actual manufacturers, because they could drop their prices and there's nothing you could do about it, you know, because you already own the product and now you're just trying to move it. And I felt like I was chasing my tail a little bit. So I was like, you know what, you know, I've traveled the country to, like, you know, New Mexico, Texas, all these big hot sauce conventions, tasting thousands and thousands of sauces as a buyer. And I was like, you know what? It'd be a lot easier, a lot more fun if I just do my own brand. I was inspired of Coney Island. I love the branding. I love, you know, the history of Coney Island. I love the look. I love being there. And I felt like, you know, let me incorporate Coney Island into a sauce, because I felt like, you know, hey, Coney Island is kind of like, there's thrills there. You know, and there's thrills in hot sauce, and I'm from Brooklyn, and I've been going there forever, and I thought I made a good match. So here I am, selling Coney Island Saucery hot sauces.
And what about the face in the middle? Who's that supposed to be? It looks like the Joker.
Oh, so that's the steeplechase face, or the Coney Island funny face. So if you go to Coney Island, you're going to see that face everywhere. So that face is actually public domain also, because it's so old. But that's not the original face. We actually recreated that face for ourselves. So we have a unique version of it. And that's trademarked. You know what I'm saying? Like we got that whole copywritten and all that good stuff. So we have that. But, you know, if you see it, you know what it is. But the real funny thing is, though, I do a lot of, like, events in Jersey. And in Jersey, everyone's like, oh, that's Tilly. Oh, you got Tilly. all day long. I'm hearing Tilly. And I'm like, Tilly came 75 years after the steeplechase face. And from what I read and researched, was Tilly in Asbury Park. There's a big Tilly there and on a building. And it's basically a nod to Coney Island, like respect. Because they're kind of like doing the same kind of a genre on the boardwalk.
Right.
So that's what that face is. That's called the steeplechase face. You call it the Coney Island face. Ours is not Tilly. But after, when I'm in Jersey, people say enough times, I just say, yeah, sure.
It's Tilly.
It's Tilly-ish.
I was in Coney Island last month, and yeah, you see that face all over the place. So I know exactly what it is. When you see that face, I think Coney Island.
It is. I mean, that is the representation of Coney Island, you know. So, you know, I mean, you know, we did it, and, you know, we sell in Coney Island. We sell out of the Sideshow Museum there on Surf Avenue. They're very good for us. I mean, to us, that we sponsor their galas. We give a bunch of free products, so like their VIPs get a bottle, and you also sell the Mermaid Parade there. Yeah, so I mean, I love Coney Island, you know, but
yeah,
like I was saying, it's changed quite a bit.
Yeah,
I was a kid.
I gotta say that if anybody's in Coney Island, definitely check out the Sideshow, because that is it was a fun show. I remember going to that; it was a very fun show.
You could watch people swallowing swords. And then later on, you could swallow hot sauce.
Exactly.
It's swordish.
Yeah, what's really nice is that it's, you know, from your childhood memory, and this, you've made a company name out of it. That's great.
Yeah, it was funny because Sketchy Rides, we were talking about, like, you know, in my bio there.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, like, what's a sketchy ride?
So there's the Thunderbolt, the original Thunderbolt. So there's a new Thunderbolt there now. So they had the original Thunderbolt. I remember that which they dismantled. Oh, God. It breaks my heart with Coney Island. And honestly, a lot of it breaks my heart because, like, a couple of years ago, they had the last remaining original building in Coney Island, which they stripped and tore down. And man, if they were selling for $2 million, and if I just had $5 million to buy it, renovate it, do something wonderful with it for the community, for the history, I would have done it. But they bought a big company, bought it, tore it down, and now it's just these dinky. What is it? What do you do when you put on boats? Those big containers, those giant containers.
Yeah, right. Yes.
They have a bunch of those. They convert them to like micro stores. Okay. And it was it was Victorian. It really hurt me when they did that. And I was just like, man, let me just win this lottery and take that over. And where were we going with that again? With the...
No, we were talking about your childhood memories.
Yeah. So my brother and me went on the original Thunderbolt, you know, back in the day, especially in the 80s, things weren't as safe as they are now. You know what I'm saying? So I think I was maybe like 7 and my brother was like 5, and we had our own cart, and he was in front of me, and it was just a bar, like those old school bars that go in front of you. He was a little too small. He passed the height test. He was a little too small to be on that thing, man. Dude, he was sliding. Sliding. He was crying and sliding. And I'm sitting there like, and it's loud, so I'm trying to scream, it's okay, it's okay. He's good. Man, I felt so bad, you know, and it was all rickety. I guess it went down for a reason.
Aaron, let's talk about the sauces. When we were at Pig Island, Jeff saw the sauce, and he's like, Trailer Park Boys, Trailer Park Boys. And apparently he found out about it from someone else, but
yeah,
very popular. Now it's on Netflix. It was a Canadian show, very popular show. How do you end up doing hot sauce for Trailer Park Boys?
My business partner is his name is Todd Maitland, and he's nominated for 5 Academy Awards for sound. He's done like Born on the 4th of July. He did Tootsie. He did some of the original MASH series. He did West Side Story with Steven Spielberg. He's a big guy, mm-hmm. you know, as a sound mixer in the industry. Originally, he did a film in Nova Scotia where Mike Smith, who plays Bubbles, who doesn't look like Bubbles, by the way. He does the character. A lot of people mix that up. He worked for him as an assistant sound mixer for a film. And they became very good friends. Through the years, he ended up, you know, keeping in touch with him and hanging out. And Mike helped develop the Trailer Park Boys. Then he became the character Bubbles. I put together, you know, that burlesque DVD with Todd. And we dabbled a couple of businesses that, you know, we realized wasn't for us. And I currently left Hot Sauce Willie's. And I was like, I want to do my own brand. And so I was like, I don't know what to do. And he was like, well, I know these guys. I know these Trailer Park Boy guys. And I was like, really? And I honestly, in the beginning, I didn't really know much about it. I've seen the memes a million gajillion times. I never really got to absorb it. And he was like, let's have a conversation. And so he decided, after me pulling his leg a lot, to be my partner again in business. Because the reason being is that he did a bunch of businesses, and we can get into that. But he was like, I don't know if I want to do another business. I was like, let's do another business. You know me. And we work well together. And he's like, all right, let me talk to them and stuff like that. And it basically was like a yes on a first conversation with them. When that happened, we ended up really putting the business together. And I ended up, once we got the okay, I ended up watching every single episode and every single movie and every single thing that they did, period, for a month straight. I mean, I got three monitors right now, and my one monitor was dedicated to Trailer Park Boys. And when I got through it all, I was actually really bummed out that there was no more to watch. I was like, that's it? You know, you only have like 20 years worth of content in a month. And I wanted more, you know? So there's a big joke. So we got the contract, and there's a big joke on the show when the character Ricky is kind of homeless and he's living out of his car. And Julian is renting out the space to him on the side of his trailer park unit. He didn't pay his bills. So he had this micro barbecue on top of his car cooking, roasting chicken fingers. And he got pissed off, and he takes a hockey stick, which is very Canadian, and knocks it off, and the chicken fingers fall on the floor. He's like, what are you doing? It was a good kind of chicken fingers, $8. So I was like, all right, our first sauce is going to be something that's got to taste good on chicken fingers.
Right? And that's decent, right?
That's like decent. And the character Bubbles goes a lot like, he's always like, decent. Oh, that's deep. You know, so I was like, all right. And it makes sense because it's a decent hot sauce. So it worked branding wise. It worked across the board, you know, and that's how that kind of worked out.
Nice. Yeah. Nice. Yeah. And by the way, everybody can go to ConeyIslandSorcery.com if you want to purchase some of these great hot sauces. I tasted the Ricky Smokes Let's Go hot sauce, and it was very, very good. So kudos to you. Kudos to you. And I want to tell you, I mean, I'm looking at the store locator on your website, and you are really all over the country and even international in Canada and
also
international.
In England and also
in England.
In
yeah,
France
look at that.
As well.
Wow. That's fantastic. How did you able to branch out that far?
Well, it was a whole lot of cold calling, I'll tell you that. Like, every Monday would be sales day, and we go out and, you know, scour the internet for stores. Some of them I knew from being a retailer, but we would make a lot of phone calls and be like, hey, you know, we got the sauce. And we'll send you samples, and they taste it, and they know the brand as well, and they would pick it up, you know. And some of it is from, like, there's online wholesale sites, you know, you could say, hey, you know, we're available for wholesale, and they'll go to the site and they'll just buy from us. So that's some discovery right there. And, you know, also we advertise all over our social, and we do tons of shows, including Pig Island, which you met me at. So we do a lot of that. And that's a lot of discovery right there, you know? And be honest, the hardest part of what I do is to get into people's mouths. But once it's in their mouth, then that's it. Then it's salt.
Right.
You know, because people see hot sauce and they're like, oh, you know, I'm scared. Like, how hot is it? You know,
that's me.
Like, I'm going to regret this, you know? And with our sauces, our current lineup, nothing is regrettable. Everything, the only regret is that you didn't buy more.
Right.
Well, Aaron, there are people who don't care about the taste. They just want the hotter, the better, right? They just want SCOVY to the moon. I don't know what level, you know.
The chili has.
But a good, right. But to me, a good hot sauce is taste and heat. What makes a great hot sauce, and how do you not go too hot, not with the taste? What, take us through the process.
Well, the thing is that, like, when I was a buyer, I had to train my mouth to eat everything.
Right.
You know, so I would eat normally ultra hot just to keep my palate used to it. And it's rough. I'll get the hottest of the hot, and I'll put it all over my burger. And it hurt. Like, it tasted great, a lot of these, but they were like, it was rough. And after a while, it's like, I guess it's kind of like bourbon or whiskey. You know, when you're a kid, it tastes like crap, right? It's terrible. But once you get a palate for it, you start to notice the nuances and what you like and what's, you know, quality whiskey and what's not. Same thing with beer. Same thing with anything you put in your mouth, right? You know, any kind of food or drink or anything like that. So, but the thing is that now I don't have to do that anymore. You know, my tolerance has gone down, and I kind of understand what the normal human being enjoys. You know, as I make a sauce, like, I'll sit there and everything. When I make a sauce, I make it by the gram. Every ingredient is by the gram, because we scale it up to a few hundred gallons from, like, a small batch of my house, which is a recipe, right? So, like, if I feel like it's getting a little too hot, then I could just reduce it. But at the same time, like, I bring my samples to a lot of shows and have people taste it. But also, the majority of people like hot, but they don't like ultra hot. And that's a small minority in the world, you know? Like, those dudes are like, no matter what you do, you can sit there and put it on a freaking red piece of charcoal right out of the barbecue and put it in their mouths, and they're like, that's it? You know? But to control it, I could taste, I sense what's going on with the sauce, and I feel this is a tolerable heat. And like I said, I also test it out, you know. But with those guys, those ultra hot dudes in the hot sauce industry, like, you got those dudes. I did a show in New Jersey. It was like the Hot Air Balloon Festival, and it's weird because every show I do in different regions, it's a different, like, so Staten Island, for instance, our decent sauce is like all good all day. At that show, it was like, what's your hottest one? What's your hottest one? What's your hottest one? It's not hot enough. It's not hot enough. It's not hot enough, right? So in the industry, for guys like that, we call it the shut the F up sauce. Because they come in, they're all strong. Nothing's hot enough for me. And you make a sauce that's so hot that the second that they put it in their mouths, they just shut up. They're like, yeah, done. Done, 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 done. Those guys, yeah, those guys are very interesting. And also, there's a big thing with recovering addicts who enjoy that sauce.
Really?
So, yeah. So the thing is like this. So they can't, they're all in recovery. They don't get high on alcohol or drugs or anything like that, but they'll get high on hot sauce. And those are the guys who are searching for the ultra hot stuff. And they call it like riding the pepper.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. So they'll take those ultra hots and sauces and or peppers and eat them. And what they're craving for is the endorphin release, the natural endorphin release in your body. Mm. So they'll sit there and they'll hit it. They'll throw. Sometimes you see people throw up It's crazy. Or they'll take tinctures of capsaicin extract and just dab their mouth just to get that real hot. And then they'll be like, yeah, now I'm good. Now I'm good. So there's a whole thing on the ultra hots, controlling heat but the majority of people don't want to get lit like that. You know, like they want something that has a kick, but you know, they want to taste what they're eating. Because otherwise you might as well just get a reaper, grow a reaper in your backyard and just munch on that thing, you know?
Exactly. Do you go around, I mean, we met you at Pig Island, but do you go around to all these shows every weekend? Or, you know, do you have a season that you go out on the road?
Yeah, it's usually starts around April till October. Mm-hmm. Like, once October hits, I'll do some shows, but I don't do anything outdoors, period. I made that mistake. It's too damn cold. It's miserable. It's freezing. Unless it's like an incredible, amazing show that I know, like, you know, people are going to just buy. Just like that. Thank you. That's online.
Yeah. You know, Aaron, I guess the once hot sauce that everybody seems to know is like Frank's Red Hot.
Yes.
And that's almost like taking a generic barbecue sauce and comparing it to, like, you know, the best, but it's on the shelf. What are we going to do about that? We got to replace all the Frank's Red Hots with the Trailer Park Boys.
Well, the thing is that Frank's Red Hot, and that's a Louisiana style.
Okay.
Right? Bosco's a Louisiana style. Crystal's a Louisiana style. And those sauces have three ingredients in it. It's just salt, pepper, and vinegar, and that's it. And those are very old established brands. They produce about 70,000 gallons a day or some crazy number like that.
Wow.
And they're able to get it down to about probably wholesale about 50 cents to a dollar a bottle. It is the best known hot sauce style in America. So it's like, that's why you see it in the restaurants. That's why you see it on the shelves, because it's low cost, high profit, you know. Gotcha. But they're established for, I think Tabasco recently, a few years ago, maybe 10 years ago or something like that. I think it was 6 years ago. They had their 100th year anniversary. So they were there for 100 years. So they were the first to market. One of the first to market. Their scale is so large. And it goes with anything. It goes, the more you get, the cheaper each unit goes, the more you can produce. So they kind of have that that footprint in that industry. To get them off that industry is very difficult. Another reason is because I'm in the craft hot sauce world. So we're doing a lot more than just three ingredients. Our Decent, for instance, is a Louisiana style, but it has the fermented cayenne in there, but it also has fresh garlic, fresh basil, and margarine, which gives it a buffalo flair. You know, all those little extra ingredients brings up the price. And then when you're at a smaller batch level than those guys, then your costs are way higher. So it's really depends on the consumer, if they're looking for a higher quality product or they're just looking for straight up three ingredient product.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a difficult thing, because there's thousands of my small batch hot sauce guys out there who make incredible stuff. But to compete in that world is extremely expensive. You need a lot of money. I mean, recently I saw a guy, I'm not going to say who it was, but he was on Shark Tank. He's got a great sauce. And you know, he sent me samples before I closed down, so I didn't carry them at that time. What happened there was, he was like, yeah, we sold our first year $1 million in sales. But he was something like $2-3 million in debt.
not going to make much money that way.
All he did was give himself a golden shovel to bury himself into the dirt.
Right.
So you got to start small. You got to go with smaller specialty stores, guys who buy outright. Distribution is very difficult, very expensive. Supermarkets in general do not sell food. They sell real estate.
Right.
So you know, and they have things called slotting fees. Mm-hmm. So if you want to get into a supermarket chain, say, like, I'm throwing out average numbers, all right? So if you want to be in 10 large chain supermarkets, they're going to charge you $1,000 per store just to get in. Then they're going to want a free case of each sauce just to get in. And you can't make your money back until all that sauce is sold and they do a multiple reorders. If the sauce doesn't sell, then they charge you to throw it out.
Ugh.
So you're looking at about $15,000 right there.
Yeah, no, that doesn't make sense.
Extremely difficult to get in that game. Sure. But we're in, you know, multiple stores, but we're in a lot of mom and pops, specialty stores.
We've seen them around. There's all these hot sauces stores, around. So yeah, we've seen them. When we saw you at Pig Island, you did mention that you might have another person coming on to, I guess, promote the product, and that was Cassandra Peterson, better known as Elvira, Mistress of the Dark.
Yes.
How'd you get in with her?
We're doing pretty good. I sent her a couple of things. She sent some adjustments. She has a very well-established palette. You know, what we're doing is we're going to send her three more flavors. Actually, today and last night, I was just reworking different flavors for her. This week, she'll be receiving three more flavors, and hopefully that one of them will be the winner.
All right.
So you've got to impress Elvira and
Elvira, yes.
Her pick one.
I do have to bring my inner darkness in because she is the mistress of the dark. So
yes, she is.
I gotta put it. I gotta find a way to put it in a bottle. And
it's not a perfume in a bottle. It's hot sauce. Much better.
Exactly. You can't eat perfume, even though like a lot of greens are perfumed. You could use like coriander, a lot of the stuff that's in a lot of perfumes actually are ingredients in food, which is funny. They're just extracts mixed, blended together, but you can't put it in your mouth and eat it. No.
So we're talking with Aaron Epstein, the owner of Coney Island Sorcery. I mentioned the website, ConeyIslandSorcery.com, but are you on any other social media?
Yeah, we're on TikTok. We're on YouTube. We're on Twitter. We're on Facebook. Yeah, that's all our socials right now.
I saw an ad that they did too for the hot sauce with one of the Trailer Park Boys.
Saw
something, a video, right? There was a video online.
Was it the Ricky Smokes Let's Go?
He's wearing the green hood.
Oh, the green bastard. Yeah,
the big glasses. Yeah.
That's Bubbles' alter ego, his wrestling alter ego called the Green Bastard from Parts Unknown.
So he was in a hot sauce online commercial for the which is the one, the green one?
That's the Green Bastard.
Yes, that's what he was doing. Yes.
Yeah, they did a bunch of stuff for us, you know. They're amazing guys, you know, and we consider them friends, and you know, we'll do whatever we can for them, and you know, they definitely hook us up and push for us, which is great. You know, they're like, you know, whatever they want, they get. So, like, for instance, like, you know, they invited us to the Niagara Falls Comic Con on the Canadian side. It was great. You know, they got us the hotel rate there, you know, their rate. And, the whatever rate for the celebrities, I guess, or whatever it is. And, you know, we just hung out with them. We partied and had a good time, you know, and they're very just straight up great people, and we're very lucky to be associated with them.
Well, Aaron, we thank you for joining us. Everybody check out ConeyIslandSorcery.com, order some hot sauce there, or check out their store locator. You can get them if you're in the neighborhood. And Aaron, I hope you're on your next show. You're not as hot. It'll be not as hot as your hot sauce. Better weather than the next one.
I sell photos too.
Oh, do you?
$20 on an autograph.
Oh, there you go. And you also have some merchandise on there, also some t-shirts that you sell. So they look pretty good. And please check it out. Aaron, thank you very much for joining us on Baseball and BBQ.
Thank you, Aaron.
Thank you so much, man. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Aaron. You know, Jeff, this episode is so long that the playoffs are now over. So they, I mean, they not only are the playoffs over, but the World Series is over. It's all over. We're at the Super Bowl. I mean, that's now this was a lot of episode, and everybody should know that we are brought to you by Bet Online. It is where the game starts. Jeff, we're not starting. We're stopping.
No, we're not.
How do we
end? We're around about third base, and the coach says, stop. Don't go home. We're stopping now.
Yes. This episode is like what baseball was like before they had the time clock.
Yes.
The pitch clock.
Exactly.
We are pre-pitch clock baseball.
Exactly.
So we're going to end, and we're going to thank everyone. Greg Olson, Aaron Epstein, you, me, our audience, everybody. And
how about Greg Rempe?
We'll thank Greg Rempe, too.
Why not?
Yeah. Why not? Who else you want to thank?
John Solberg, Doug Scheiding, Rusty Monson.
Hey, how about Gary Mack?
Gary Mack, Rich Baxter.
Yeah.
Baseball PhD.
Exactly.
But we can go on and on.
And we usually do. So
yes. We're
going to end. Now we're ending with the poet, Shel Krakowski, the musician, Dave Dresser, and the song. Jeff, what is it?
Baseball always brings you home. And we'll see you next time on episode number 209.